has made great thing out of this day, a big deal, if you will, out of this day that we call Easter Sunday. Now we realize God in His Word has commanded that we not celebrate days. But yet, this has become a day that the world focuses a little more intently on the resurrection of Jesus. And since the world at large focuses more intently on the resurrection of Jesus today than any other time, it seems appropriate that we should focus on the resurrection of Jesus also. Because our focus is really not on a bunny rabbit that lays colored eggs. And it's not our focus is actually not on a fashion parade. And of course, admittedly, Easter is not the fashion parade today that once upon a time it was. I can remember a time when I have heard my mother and other ladies sitting around talking, you know, in late February. And, well, I found the most beautiful hat for Easter. I've just got to find a dress to go with it. Or people, oh, I've got this beautiful dress. I've got to go find a hat. And then your Easter Sunday would come. And nobody focused on the sermon. Nobody heard a word the preacher said. In the first place, if you were sitting out in the audience, you had to try to shift from one side to the other or kind of crane up to see over the hat of the lady sitting in front of you. And then there'd be a lady, did you see that hat that Sister So-and-so was wearing? I have never seen a more hideous outfit in my life. And it was all about the clothes. And it was also, you know, and some of the men would get in on the act too. I always remember that many years ago, I always looked forward to Easter Sunday because I could put on my black and white two-tone shoes Easter Sunday and I could wear them then until Labor Day. Norma put a stop to black and white two-tone shoes. She won't even let me. I found some last year that she wouldn't even let me buy them. You can feel sorry for me. I'd appreciate any sympathy that I could get. But it's not a fashion show anymore on Easter Sunday. So the bunny that lays colored eggs and the hats and the fashion show and what we can wear and can't wear, that's not the important thing for our consideration this morning. So far as the church is concerned, the message of the season is in our text in Luke chapter 24. It was early in the morning of the first day of the week and they had come to the grave, the tomb where Jesus had been laid. They were coming there to prepare the body for burial. And the angel said, "Why seek you the living among the dead? He is not here. He is risen." Did it really happen? Did the Lord really rise from the dead? Is it really true that Jesus Christ is alive? Was that tomb in Jerusalem that day, was it really empty? Can we believe that that really happened? Either we believe the tomb was empty as a flaming truth, or it's the hideous falsehood of the Christian gospel. And it's important for us to know which one it really is. What did happen in that far-off day in Jerusalem? I want you this morning, I want you to use your sanctified imagination. And I want you to go back with me by an eye of faith to Jerusalem in the first century. It's nighttime. And 12 men are gathered together in an upper room in the city. Their hearts are heavy because they know that something is about to happen. And these men are apprehensive. You see, this is Jesus' last night on earth. And Jesus has looked forward to this occasion. He told His apostles, His chosen friends, He said, "I have looked forward. I have desired to eat this Passover with you before I suffered." His intimate companions were there in that room with Him. I want you to visualize the scene. I want you to see the strong hands of Jesus the carpenter as He takes the bread, and I want you to see Him And I want you to watch as Jesus breaks that bread. And He hands it to those men. He says, take and eat. This is My body that is given for you. This do in remembrance of Me. That Last Supper was to institute a memorial. It was the loving desire of Jesus Christ to be remembered. And Jesus relied on common, everyday symbols for that memorial feast. The feast we observed just a few moments ago. A piece of bread and a cup of juice of the lowly grape. Those were the emblems chosen by Jesus to recall Him to future generations. Jesus Christ wanted us to remember His death. He never asked that we would commemorate His birth. Not once did He request that any of the wonderful deeds that He'd performed would be immortalized. Only this. His crowning achievement, His greatest work, the work of redemption. He wanted us to remember that. Outside that upper room that night, it's silent. The night is dark, and the supper is over. And when they'd sung a hymn, they went out to the dark and deserted streets of Jerusalem. They walked past the lower pool. They walked through the fountain gate. They crossed the brook Kidron. And this group, Jesus and His companions, they moved up the hill toward one of their favorite destinations. It was the Garden of Gethsemane. And Jesus told His disciples to sit while He went to pray. And Jesus went a little deeper into the garden. And He took three of His closest companions, Peter and James and John, and they went deeper into the garden. And then Jesus left them. And He said, I want you to watch and pray. And then Jesus went even further into the garden. I want you to see Jesus there. I want you to see as He says, my soul is exceedingly sorrowful unto death. I want you to see Him fall to His knees and pray to God, my Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from Me. You see, Jesus knew the cross was facing Him. Jesus was a man. He was also God. But every ounce, every inch of His manhood shrank from the end that He was facing. And while Jesus is praying, while He's in agony, while He says, Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from Me. While He's doing that, His apostles were asleep. While Jesus prayed, they slept. And as He prayed, He said, Father, not My will, but Thine be done. Jesus prayed so fervently, so earnestly. He prayed in such agony that night in the garden. In your forehead, in your scalp, there are tiny capillaries. And I was told by a medical doctor, a good friend of mine, that in times of great stress and in times of great distress, those capillaries can actually burst. And that's why you read in the accounts of the gospel that as Jesus prayed, as He fell to His knees, He said, Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from Me. The sweat from His brow mingled with the blood from His body, and sweat as great drops of blood soaked into the ground where Jesus was praying. And then He goes to the disciples, He finds them asleep, and then suddenly the stillness of the garden is broken by voices. The low sound of voices. And then a torch comes into view. And then another torch. And then still more. And there were soldiers. twigs crackled under their feet as they stooped to pass under the low-hanging branches of the olive trees. And out of the crowd steps a familiar figure. It's Judas. Do you see him? Do you see the faint smile on his face? Do you see him as he says, "Hail, Master," and comes and places the traitor's kiss on the cheek of my Lord? And having been identified, the soldiers seized Jesus. And they led him away in the same way you might lead a steer to the slaughterhouse. And that unholy procession made its way to the house of Annas. And they escorted Jesus inside. We talked about all of that last week. And then Jesus was taken in front of Caiaphas. And then they led him from Caiaphas to the house of Pilate. The Roman governor, Pilate, he was not in the best of moods that morning. He was not especially happy to rise so early in the morning to have to try a case. These Jewish people that Caesar had sent him to rule were a difficult race, a turbulent race of people. And his occupation army was always trying to keep the lid on some kind of a smoldering volcano among these Jews. Pilate had a soldier's contempt for religion. He was, after all, a Roman soldier. And no prayers, no mystic rites could ever stand up against the Roman legions. And these religious Jews baffled him. And they also irritated him. I want you to see Pilate in your mind's eye this morning. I want you to see him make his way down the stairs of the palace. He has his purple bordered toga over his arm. And he looks out and he sees this seething mass of humanity in front of him. And they seem centered around one solitary man who's being thrust forward. And the governor's first impression is that he's utterly harmless. Pilate has the eyes of a trained soldier, and he looks Jesus over. He looks for signs of weapons, and there are none. The prisoner is dressed in a simple, white, seamless robe, open at the neck. It's wrinkled, it's soiled from the rough handling, and his hands are bound behind his back. Pilate asks them, he says, "What accusation are you bringing against Jesus?" Can you hear them? Almost snarling. "If he were not an evildoer, we wouldn't have brought him to you, Pilate." But Pilate wants no part of the proceedings. He says, "Take him. Judge him according to your law." Now's when the truth comes out. They reminded Pilate of something. They said, "Pilate, it's not lawful for us to put someone to death." There it is. That's their objective. That's ultimately what they wanted, was to put Jesus to death. Their eyes are filled with bloodlust. So Pilate wants to have some words with Jesus alone. And he goes back and takes Jesus into the palace. He asks Jesus, he said, "Are you the King of the Jews?" And Jesus wanted to know. He said, "Pilate, did someone tell you this, or did you think about this all on your own?" And that's when Jesus told him, he said, "Pilate, my kingdom is not of this world." Well, Pilate's growing weary with the interview. He's already found out what he wanted to know, and that is that Jesus is harmless. He goes out to the mob. He says, "I find no fault with this man." And that makes the chief priests even angrier than they already were. And they start spitting and spewing out their accusations. And Luke says they said, "Well, Jesus stirred up the people beginning from Galilee." And then the lights went on in Pilate's brain. He sees a loophole. When he heard the word Galilee, that's when that loophole appeared. Herod is over that jurisdiction. And Herod's in town for the feast. He said, "Well, Herod is the one that has jurisdiction. Take him to Herod and let Herod try the case, because it's in his jurisdiction. Pilate's wife had already warned him. She said, "Don't you have anything to do with the blood of this just man? I've been troubled in a dream because of him." So Pilate's in a predicament. He's between the proverbial rock and a hard place. If he lets Jesus go, then the Jewish leadership will accuse him of being the enemy of Caesar. And yet, by his own admission, Pilate finds no fault in Jesus. So Pilate, since it was the custom to release a prisoner at the feast, he brings in front of the crowd the insurrectionist Barabbas. And he asks, "Who would you that I would release to you?" And they said, "Give us Barabbas." He said, "What then shall I do with Jesus?" They said, "Let him be crucified." Pilate says, "I'm washing my blood." He'd asked for a basin. He washed his hands. He said, "I'm washing my blood of the blood of this, my hands of the blood of this just man." And those Jews said, "Let his blood be on us, and let his blood be on our children." Jesus is on his way to Calvary. And Matthew tells us the very first thing that Jesus must endure is a scourging. Scourging was one of the most brutal forms of punishment ever devised. Jesus was stripped of his clothing and tied to a post. There were two primary methods of scourging. One, a post would have been about waist high. And the person being scourged would be down on their knees and bent over the post with their hands tied together on the other side of the post. Another method was a tall post where the person being scourged would be stretched up with their hands tied high above their head. And then the scourging would begin. A Roman legionnaire would step forward. He would have something in his hand similar to what we would call a cat of nine tails. It'd be a leather whip with multiple ends on it. And at the end of each strip of leather would be a piece of lead or a piece of bone tied to cut into the flesh. And that heavy whip is brought back and it's hurled against the back of my Lord as hard as a husky Roman soldier can swing that whip. Again and again, it's brought down across his back and his legs 39 times. 39 times they brought that whip on the back of my Lord. Those small balls of lead or those bits of bone do such awesome damage that finally the skin of the back is just hanging in long ribbons. And the entire back, that entire back. Have you ever seen a piece of steak tartare? You'll never look at it again the same way. Because the entire back of Jesus is an unrecognizable mass of bleeding flesh. And you know what they do with that torn, bleeding flesh? The prisoner's near death. There's a pool of blood at his feet. And the beating is stopped. And half fainting, Jesus is untied and he slumps to the pavement in his own blood. And the Roman soldiers see a great joke in this provincial Jew that claims to be a king. So they throw a robe across his shoulders and place a stick in his hand as a scepter. Oh, but now we're going to make him a king, so we've got to make the ridicule complete. So they find a bundle of flexible branches covered with long thorns. Now, we're not talking about thorns from a berry bush. We're talking about thorns, okay? Thorns. And they plait those flexible vines together and they press that down on the head of my Lord. And they don't just let it rest there. They push it in. Those thorns dig into the flesh of his head and his scalp. And they mock him. And they strike him across the face. They take the stick from his hand and they strike him across the head. And they drive the thorns deeper and deeper into his scalp. And finally, they tire of this sadistic sport. But time has passed, hasn't it? They had thrown a robe on his back. What was his back when they threw that robe? It was a mass of bleeding flesh. But the blood has had time to dry into that robe. The wounds, some have had time to scab over. Imagine the pain. Did you ever have a little scab that the Band-Aid stuck to and you ripped it off and it hurt? Imagine your whole back is nothing but a mass of bleeding flesh and you've got a giant robe and they rip it off your back. Imagine the pain that Jesus endured right there. And they make him pick up his cross. And he begins a 650-yard journey to a place called Golgotha. In spite of his efforts to walk erect, the weight of that cross, that heavy wooden cross, is too much. And he stumbles and slumps under the weight of that cross. Not because he's not every inch a man, but because of the terrific beating he has just endured. His precious blood drips and splatters on the stony cobblestone streets of Jerusalem. The adoring crowds from earlier in the week are gone, and a man by the name of Simon, a pilgrim from Cyrene who's in town for the feast, they have to compel him to carry the cross of Jesus. And finally, they arrive at Calvary. And the cross piece that Jesus has been carrying is thrown to the ground. And when they throw that to the ground, Jesus is quickly thrown backward, his soldiers, against that piece of wood that he brought to Calvary. Take your hand. Feel right there for that depression right behind your wrist. Because that's what the Roman legionnaire did. He found that depression there in the wrist of Jesus and he stretched him out and he drove a nail through it and fastened it to the cross piece. Then he takes the other arm and he finds that depression and he drives a nail through that side. A heavy, square, wrought iron nail through the wrist and deep into the wood. And then the cross piece is lashed to the upright. The cross is lifted into place. It drops into a hole in the ground. They rush up and put some dirt on it. And they put a placard above it. Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews. So there he is hanging. His entire body weight on two nails. One in each wrist. So quickly they rush up. And with both feet extended, toes down, they press the left foot backward against the right foot. And with both feet extended, toes down, a nail, we're talking a serious nail now, is driven through the arches and leaves his knees flexed. And Jesus is now crucified. I want you to see him. Keep using that sanctified imagination. Keep using an eye of faith. And I want you to see Jesus as he slowly sags down. But as he sags down, all of his weight is on his wrist and the pain is excruciating. Excruciating, fiery pain shoots along his fingers, up the arms, explodes in his brain. The nails are putting pressure on the median nerves. So with his feet, he pushes himself upward to avoid that scorching torment in his arms and hands. And that places the full weight on the nail that's through his feet. So there's the agony of the nail tearing down the nerves and the bone, tearing between the nerves and the bones of his feet. And the Roman soldiers look at him. They look at this so-called king and they wag their heads and they laugh at him as he's suspended there between heaven and earth. After hours of torment, Jesus momentarily lifted his weight from the cross with His feet. That allowed Him to fill His lungs to make one final proclamation. He said, "It is finished. Father, into Thy hands I commend my spirit." And with that statement, pandemonium broke loose. Nature convulsed. The sun refused to shine. The birds refused to sing. Earth convulsed. Hell rejoiced. And heaven stood amazed. And a Roman soldier rushes up and thrusts a spear into his side. And blood, mingled with water, flowed from the side of my Lord. Now give me just a moment. Indulge me a moment. And let me describe death by crucifixion. It's the most ignominious death that a man could die. It's the most cruel form of punishment that man's inhumanity to man has ever devised. You see, it's actually a slow and painful death by suffocation. The lungs fill with water. And the one being crucified actually ultimately drowns in their own body fluids. The reason the knees are kept flexed is because the only way that the person being crucified can breathe is to push up with their feet and get some, relieve the pressure enough to take a breath. That's why that if they weren't already dead, they would come and break their legs so they wouldn't be able to breathe anymore. When that Roman soldier came and he thrust that spear into the side of Jesus, he didn't just pierce his skin. The blood that flowed from the side of my Lord was blood that flowed from His heart. The water that flowed from the side of my Lord was water that flowed from His lungs. That spear went deep enough into the body of Jesus that it went through His heart, went into His lungs, and the blood and water that flowed down His side was from His lungs and His heart. Jesus was dead. The mob had gotten what they wanted. But that is not the end of the story. You see, the cross is only the beginning. Listen again to the words that we read at the very beginning this morning. "Why seek you the living among the dead? He's not here. He's risen." It's no wonder Paul would write in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, "So when this corruptible shall have put on incorruption, and this mortal shall have put on immortality, then shall be brought to pass the saying that is written, Death is swallowed up in victory. O death, where is thy sting? O grave, where is thy victory? The sting of death is sin. The strength of sin is the law." Now listen to it. "But thanks be to God who gives us the victory through our Lord Jesus Christ." With that death on the cross, Jesus paid my sin debt. And He paid your sin debt. He had told the apostles that night in the upper room that He was going away. He said, "I'm going to the Father's house. There are many mansions there, and I'm going to prepare a place for you there." That's when Thomas said, "Lord, we don't know where you're going. How do we know the way?" And Jesus said, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man comes to the Father but by me." Have you ever given Him your life? Have you ever completely given your life to Jesus? Have you in simple trusting faith confessed His name, repented of sin, and been buried in the waters of baptism for the remission of those sins? If you haven't, I'd beg you to do it before you leave this building this morning. But have you done that? But you haven't lived God's kind of life, and you haven't lived God's life the way Jesus would have you to live. We're going to sing a song in just a couple of moments. Probably even less than that. We call it a song of encouragement. A song to encourage you to make changes that might be needed to make in your life. Changes that we would love to help you with. Can we do that? It's your opportunity to do that as we stand and while we sing.